You people should stop buying shitcoins, because shitcoins are a financial risk for society. Only buy Bitcoin before you get financially wrecked. Consult with a professional before investing. So let me change my image. Hey, Ricardo. How's it going?
Hey, not too bad on you.
Ah, too much going on about here. How was the presentation?
It was good. It was, it's always weird doing it like virtually and not physically being there. But yeah, other than that, it was great. I enjoyed it.
There we go. Okay, so I think we're going to be okay. We had this fun thing that maybe we should have this combine episode, because Bex kind of forced you onto me, so I kind of feel violated. nonetheless, it was because we were supposed to have anonymous Bitcoiner on the show, who is actually here. I think he's here. Say hello. Unmute yourself. I don't know who the hell it is anymore. But since Ricardo is here, he came up with some really interesting topic that I actually really interested in, like how we verify the supply of a privacy coin, because that's always a heated debate. And just gonna wait until the other guest kind of pops up.
Clearly, we need Jitsi on the blockchain.
Yeah, no, that's not. Or if you want to have a package every 10 minutes.
Yeah, here we go. It's the only way to fix it.
Probably, I don't know.
Microphones on the blockchain.
Gonna be interesting. If anybody can pull it out, maybe it's you. But don't introduce any tokens to it, please. Because there's enough scams out there. We can hear you, but the mic is still choppy, so I'm not really sure how we should proceed. Oh, damn it. What should we do? Okay, I don't know. I think we should go on. I don't know. I'm just gonna... okay, well, I think we can start with Fluffy Pony until we figure out this microphone issue. So yeah, hey, Ricardo. It's quite nice to see you. It's just like I wasn't really sure how I'm going to end up here with you, since I don't really have a favorable view of Monero. But
that's okay. Neither do I, so it's fine.
I've been really pushing me on the side. How do you verify the supply of something that is based on cryptographic assumptions? So what is the difference between having Bitcoin's monetary supply being auditable but only having an emission schedule on Monero? What is the difference between the two?
I feel like I just gave a talk on this.
Say for those who weren't really paying, because...
Sure. I mean, you know, look, I think I don't want to, I obviously don't want to rehash my talk. But I covered that exact topic. And I think, you know, if you really break it down, there's three possible risks. There's the risk of a cryptographic hardness assumption breaking. There's the risk of detectable inflation due to an implementation flaw. And there's the risk of undetectable inflation due to an implementation flaw.
Yeah.
Now, the cryptographic hardness assumption, I think it's fair to say that we can throw that out, because we rely on things like the discrete logarithm problem, the hardness there, for things in Bitcoin and in Monero. And frankly, if we have a cryptographic hardness assumption break, we have much bigger problems than someone can mint infinite Monero. I think at this point in time, enough of the world relies on cryptographic hardness assumptions that we can consider their risk relatively negligible. That's not to say it's negligible in everything. Of course, moon math used in new cryptographic protocols can be extremely risky because it uses a different set of assumptions. But I think the basic assumptions that we use in Monero and in Bitcoin are pretty time-tested. I don't think we need to get into a debate about all the problems of the SECP 256K1 curve. There are plenty of cryptographers that have written about its issues. But that aside, I think it's, you know, we have reasonable amounts of confidence in Bitcoin's curve, and there's a lot of confidence in Monero, in the curves that Monero uses. So it's, you know, the cryptographic assumptions I think are fairly solid, and the, you know, the risk is negligible. So let's focus on the other two, which is implementation flaws, because, you know, and I pointed this out in my talk, you can have the absolute, like the most the best cryptographic models created by the best cryptographers, reviewed by you know, the brightest minds on the planet, and all it takes is one line of code, one tiny mistake in one line of code to bring everything crashing down. So implementation flaws are far, far more likely than cryptographic hardness assumptions so, being broken.
Like, here we could say that Zcash have higher chance of failing than Monero in this example.
Yeah, so absolutely. And I think that like the if you look at the list of cryptocurrencies that have been affected by, that have had actual infinite mint or whatever, double spend, whatever we want to call them, let's just call them supply auditability bugs in the past.
Yeah,
and that includes Bitcoin, it includes Monero, it includes Zcash. Those are the three big ones that have had actual supply auditability attacks in the past. If you look at the way Monero and Bitcoin dealt with it versus the way Zcash have dealt with it, it's fascinating because Zcash have basically gone, well, we don't know if it's been exploited. We have no real way of telling if it's been exploited, but we think that the math is so complex that only five people on the planet understand it, and so it's unlikely it's been exploited, which to me is like, that's like such a weird way of saying, like, you know, this stuff is so, it's so complicated that we think no one could have figured it out and then attacked it. I fundamentally disagree with that. But that aside, I think that the complexity does increase the risk, because it's not only a new set of assumptions, a new set of cryptographic assumptions, which are not as well established as the ones that Monero and Bitcoin rely on, but you've also got this like implementation complexity that is like, it just doesn't have the same level of visibility that Bitcoin's code and Monero's code has.
Okay, so let's step back a little bit. Well, have you seen that IRS and the DHS put out basically bounties,
yeah,
for tracking Monero? What is your take on that?
So it was interesting because the bounties for tracking Monero and Lightning. So I consider that to be the, you know, from their perspective, those are clearly the big threats, right? Which is great because it means that both Monero and Lightning are moving in the right direction.
Yeah, basically.
I think, you know, like it wouldn't be a privacy enhancing technology if there weren't attackers trying to break it down, right? And privacy is not a state that you achieve. You don't go like, well, I've written this piece of code and now it achieves privacy and I can walk away. It's this constant battle. It's this constant cat and mouse game of like iterations on small improvements to get a little bit more privacy out. And then the attacker's like, oh, and we found a slight weakness here. Obviously, sometimes there's leapfrog improvements, but generally it's just iterative. And I think that that's really the only way that Lightning and Monero and Tor and I2P and all of these technologies will defend themselves is by continued iteration, continued evolution, and, you know, feeling the heat on your back from people trying to break it all the time. And it's not just the IRS, the DHS, the CIA, the FBI, the NSA. It's not just three data agencies. It's 15-year-olds in Poland, you know, and researchers at universities in China. It's people from all sorts of walks of life and areas of expertise and interest that are trying to break these things, sometimes out of curiosity, sometimes out of malice. And I think that just as people working on, as engineers working on these systems, it really behooves us to just feel that heat, feel that pressure to constantly make the system better.
So do you think this has some role in it, that basically Monero being gaining more headspace in the dark markets these days? That's why it's becoming more targeted by law enforcement these days?
You know, I don't follow a lot of the darknet market stuff. I was very curious about it at the, you know, in the early days. Nowadays, it just seems like there's been such a plethora of exit scams that that I think even figuring out like what darknet market to go to must be an exercise in and of itself. But I think, yeah, like certainly that absolutely is something that would attract the attention of law enforcement. Kind of the way I think of it is, with any privacy enhancing technology, with self-sovereign technologies, you end up with like different groups of people that are interested in them. You've always got those early adopters, and we've seen it in Bitcoin. It's you know, people who either want to use it for you know, let's call it illegal purposes or purposes that are morally reprehensible, and other people that are speculating, people that we might not agree with because they're only in it for the money. And then there's this other group of people who are people who are genuinely interested in self-sovereignty, people who are genuinely interested in the technology, and people who really need it. You know, so people in Venezuela are not buying Bitcoin because they're speculating. You know, the people in Venezuela are not shorting Ethereum on BitMEX. They are like, they're genuine. They need Bitcoin. They have an actual use for it. They rely on its technology, and it's not a joke to them. So that's sort of the way I view Monero, like Monero's user base as well. There are people who will use it for things that I do not agree with. There are people who will use it because they think it'll make them rich. But there is a group of people who have a genuine need for it. And those are the people that I care about.
So there'll be a lot of talk about tumbling through Monero. Do you think it's possible to somehow make Monero feasible for this, for creating a new type of coin join mechanism and like merging more Bitcoins through Monero, you know, atomic swap, for example, in a way that the IRS wouldn't notice it or something? Because then, you know, then easy can end up in a situation, it's not number go up or number go sideways, but number goes Guantanamo. Something like this, because you know if they are able to, you know, follow all these kind of things, then, you know, if you move large amounts of stolen Bitcoins or something at the Monero and they see the atomic swap and where the money goes after that back on chain or to Lightning, and if they have access to Lightning, because even with the what's this thing, one of the sponsor here in Parantopolis, that they can actually send now Monero straight onto Lightning, and it's like it's they are still custodial, and they could easily fall under control of a government or law enforcement to put in a subpoena there, some data request or something, and then that will be game over for people who are tumbling through it.
100%. Like, what's, I mean, I think, I think the, you know, any mixer you're using, any magical cloud of privacy that you're moving in and out of, the risk is not when you move in, it's when you move back out. You know, and unfortunately that requires incredible OPSEC, right? So if you've stolen 1,000 Bitcoin and you're trying to, let's assume that the privacy cloud that you're putting it into, whether it's Monero or something else, is just like it's just amazing and it's perfect in every way, no one can break it. You move the 1,000 Bitcoin in. When you take that out, if you're taking it out in chunks of 100 Bitcoin, you're probably going to attract a lot of attention. If you're taking it out in, you know, in 1,000 Bitcoin shot, you're going to attract a lot of attention. It's going to be pretty obvious. To actually have the OPSEC required to take it out in small random amounts matching common spending patterns, most people do not have the patience or the OPSEC for that. And I think that's really the complexity with any sort of mixer or tumbler. And it doesn't matter what the technology is. Monero is not a magic bullet for that. What I will say is if somebody who is using Bitcoin wanted to benefit from Monero's privacy, they'd probably be better off taking a small amount of of Bitcoin, like no more than they keep in their normal wallet. You know, if you walk around with 100 euros in your wallet, then you could take 100 euros worth of Bitcoin and put it in Monero and store it there and spend it directly from Monero, whether you're using XMRTO to pay a Lightning invoice or to pay a Bitcoin invoice. Doesn't really matter, because it's the origin is coming from Monero, and it's just the amount of money that you'd normally keep in your wallet, so you use it to, you know, buy coffee or whatever. That I can imagine as a totally feasible scenario. But using Monero as some sort of magical silver bullet to wash 1,000 Bitcoin, or you know, like wash $200 million worth of stolen currency that the KuCoin guy has, I just don't see that being feasible.
Yeah, like last time I was unsure how much I can talk about this thing, but I was following like $500,000 worth of Bitcoin that was stolen from a Kraken client, and every one of single one of those sets were basically tumbled through Monero over BISC in a way that they basically appeared like they were trying to acquire Monero in really large quantities. Like, and then what happened there was that then the just money started going back into places, shady places like KuCoin or whatever else. And then, but it seems still like hackers and people who still do these kind of things that Monero is the number one currency to go for.
Yeah, and I think that's a combination of two things, right? The first is like Monero from a technological perspective is interesting. You know, there is a lot of effort that's gone into to continue the continuous drumbeat of improvement for Monero's privacy, and that's a good thing. Monero doesn't make claims of having perfect privacy or anything like that, but it's got pretty strong privacy. And coupled with that is the particularly large user base. As far as privacy enhancing technology goes, Monero is like right up there. You know, it's one of the larger pools of users, and that's great because it means that if you want to get lost in the crowd, Monero has the biggest crowd, and that's really where you want to be, you know, from a privacy enhancing perspective. I do think that I'm very hopeful on privacy coming to Bitcoin. And that was one of the points I made in my talk as well, is having these discussions about supply auditability is not to try and turn it into a Bitcoin versus Monero debate. It's more to try and explain why privacy should come to Bitcoin, and we should throw out arguments like no privacy on Bitcoin because of supply auditability, which is a total garbage argument. And I explained why in my talk. Because I think that privacy
Actually, I
is
gotta
critical.
cut you here because this is
Sure.
really interesting. I mean, you are actually right in a sense that it's only valid to a point that we can assure, without a reasonable doubt, that we cannot inflate Bitcoin. Nobody can inflate it. So there is no inflation beyond emission. Or well, is this one of the options that's possible so that you cannot undo the privacy benefits of that privacy enhancing technology on Bitcoin, and then you cannot inflate it. These two basically could be a sufficient technology for Bitcoiners. But there are those others, like I know somebody all you basically who keeps saying that the ones you unable to audit the supply, then people are gonna be start coming bringing in rehypothecation. But I don't really agree with that. But the other part that is more the other route, which is if you guarantee the three possibilities that you can audit the supply, prevent inflation and with a unreversible privacy basically. But that seems like just a dream right now, doesn't it? Or is that
Well,
possible to achieve somehow?
there's lots to break down there. So firstly, let's talk about supply auditability on Bitcoin.
Yeah, sure.
Let's take a look at like the 2018 CVE on Bitcoin, which was effectively a double spend bug for transaction outputs. Okay. Now, it wasn't exploited, it was fixed. Fantastic. But let's imagine it was exploited. Okay. So now you are a genuine user. You withdraw 500 Bitcoin from an exchange into your cold wallet. An attacker double spends or spends that 500 transaction output and deposits it to an exchange. Now you come along and you want to go and take your 500 Bitcoin out of your cold wallet and actually spend it. But now it's already been spent. Okay, so now there's a transaction output double spend issue. I'm obviously using a very contrived example, but at that point, only at that point, would the inflation be discovered. And at that point, what do we do?
Yeah, it's quite catastrophic by that time, actually.
Absolutely. It's catastrophic. So
you cannot even control how the inflation proceeds. You cannot shorten the time. You cannot put in or change.
You can't roll back the chain. You can't roll back the chain. You can't block the all of the double spends, because presumably the attacker would have done a bunch of them. You can't reverse transactions that have occurred subsequently that have built on that. It's a total mess. It's a nightmare. We have no protocol for handling that. And frankly, I think it would, if that happened, it would destroy Bitcoin. So supply auditability relies on there not being any bugs in the implementation. And there have been two bugs in Bitcoin's implementation. We picked up both of them. They were handled safely, and thankfully nothing occurred. But I want to take the idea of Bitcoin having no supply auditability problems, and I want to crush that, because it's not that there are no supply auditability problems. It's just that we've managed to handle the past two incidences safely. We are hoping that there aren't any future incidences. Why? Because there are a lot of eyes on Bitcoin's code. Because researchers are kind of ideologically compelled to report issues and not try and exploit them. And also because attackers know that if they do try and exploit those issues, it would most likely destroy the value of the Bitcoin that they stole. So we're kind of protected in those three, but that's the real protection. The protection is not that supply auditability problems can't exist because of the fact that you can read the numbers in a block explorer. So I think it's important to just like make that distinction. It's a very key distinction. Supply auditability problems can and have existed on Bitcoin. And our hope is that they do not exist in future, and that if they do exist in future, that we will handle them as safely as we've handled the past two incidences. So that deals with that. Now, the other part of the statement that you were making earlier is that, somehow, like, could there be a privacy enhancing system that also is has like enough supply auditability soundness that it makes us happy? And yes, there are some things that we can do. Sorry, I have a little cough there. There are some things that we can do. For example, with Monero and with Mimblewimble, we hide transaction amounts, and this is the same on Liquid, and Elements, on Blockstream stuff. We hide transaction amounts using Peterson commitments. Now, Peterson commitments are perfectly hiding. So, in other words, it's basically impossible for you to figure out what the actual number is for that commitment. But they're computationally binding, and that means that yes, there could be some sort of critical break that lets you manipulate the underlying number. On the other hand, there's this other technology called Elgamal commitments. And Elgamal commitments are the reverse. They're computationally hiding and perfectly binding. And what that means is that there is no way, there's no known, no way of computationally figuring out a way to change the number that the commitment represents. But you end up with slightly decreased privacy, because presumably with an attacker with enough computing power, or that's figured out some sort of clever attack, could figure out what the underlying number is for Elgamal commitments. And because we don't use Elgamal commitments today, by the way, because they are so big, the range proofs are massive. Whereas with Peterson commitments, they're pretty small and compact. And once you add bulletproofs to it, they're even smaller and more compact. Now, could Monero or Mimblewimble or Liquid or Elements switch from Peterson commitments to Elgamal commitments in future? Absolutely. And in fact, Grin has the system called Switch Commitments, which is designed for that purpose, that they can actually lob a hand grenade in and switch everything over from Peterson commitments to Elgamal commitments in one file swoop. So there are ways of getting more unconditional soundness, more soundness out of the monetary system while still retaining privacy. It's just that we're not really there yet. We don't it wouldn't be a fantastic currency when transactions are massive. There's other, when they're slow to build and that sort of thing. But it is absolutely possible to have much stronger soundness guarantees while still having privacy.
It's very interesting, yeah. Well, that's what I'm going to ask. Do we have other guests in here already with the microphone working, or did he drop out? Oh, well. I had another question. I would remember it. You totally blasted with the Algamal commitments, because that's what I've been like. So basically, Algamal commitments on Bitcoin could basically totally make it possible to make privacy unreversible if it would ever be implemented, in your opinion?
Well, yeah, I mean, it would be very interesting to me if Bitcoin switched, at least implemented confidential transactions. It's not going to hide the transaction graph, but yeah, something interesting. So let's imagine a future where bandwidth is a lot more plentiful, and there is, we're all on much lower latency connections. It's 10G cell phone technology, and we all have fiber to our house. Now, in that scenario, it might actually be feasible for Bitcoin to turn on confidential transactions with Algamal commitments. And what's interesting there is it adds some degree of privacy to the base chain, because you no longer can see amounts. But you still have the normal transaction graph, and all these companies, CipherTrace and Chainalysis, they can still go, oh, we can trace transactions, no problem. But there is a massive privacy gain for Lightning, because if you are using Lightning then on that chain, and no one can see that when two channels close, they can't see what the final balances are, because the balances are behind those commitments. And so you can't even infer what payments were made by looking at closed channel balances. And that becomes very interesting, because that then changes the dynamic with Lightning privacy drastically.
How would you go about implementing this on Bitcoin?
Yeah, that's...
If you could just, wave your magic wand, and then next day it's on it. Some sort of scenario like that. Or just have an SJW implementation like last time.
Look, I mean, I think it would definitely be possible from a... technologically, it's not difficult, right? You can just say, well, we deprecate this old type of transaction, and all transactions going forward need to use confidential transactions. And there's, it's almost like a gateway, right? When you want to pay someone or move any money around in Bitcoin from that point onwards, it uses it. And it could even be done in a similar way to SegWit, where the previous style of visible transactions is still supported for some time, until some threshold is reached, like 80% of transactions use it.
So like it's similar style, like how Zcash is running. So it will be completely optional in that sense, or would you imagine it as being forced onto users after a period of time?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't imagine it being forced. I would say that, like, because you see, the thing is, you need general ecosystem support. And let's imagine we waved our magic wand and wallets just were able to support it, exchanges were able to support it, no problem. Then you could have something like when 80% of mined transaction outputs over a 10-day window are using confidential transactions, that becomes mandatory from that block onwards. And from that block onwards, you can no longer have a transaction output that has a visible amount. So that would then just be a funnel. You once you reach that critical mass, then it just kicks in, and you can no longer... you can still spend transaction outputs that are visible, but you can't create new ones with visible amounts. So that would be one way of doing it. But I think, frankly, getting the actual technical stuff down is the easy part. Getting convincing people that it's a good move after after all the effort that and all the mess that we had with SegWit, like that's a journey. That's a 10-year journey.
I mean, you just have to, think out of the box here. Like, just for a second. I mean, it worked before already. You just have to go on to the Bitcoin Core Git and then say that it's racist to be transparent. Let's quickly put in.
There we go.
Someone's going to hack it really quickly.
Great idea. You go on and you say that that when you go in a block explorer and you see the amounts, it offends your native people, and the only way to fix this is to add privacy.
Yeah, like It's the, this is what the Zcash people keep saying, that Satoshi is still without their pants. Like, yeah, but although I don't really agree with it. But yeah, how do you see if this is going to be like probably the biggest battlefield topic probably in the future? How do you see this playing out? Could this cause like a chain split or anything similar that way?
So you're right. I do kind of think this is the next battleground, and that's why
it's already playing out at least it is, partially. Totally.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting is like if you look at the Samurai versus Wasabi Wallet stuff that goes on.
Yeah.
Like that is just a taste of how it's going to go down. Like there will be people on multiple sides, and of course, you know how it goes. It is the ideal time for an attacker to sow discord. All they need to do is just plant a bunch of sock puppets in, and some of them are saying this and some of them are saying that. It'll be very difficult to band together. But I think, I think that maybe if the situation gets worse than it already is, and if governments get more authoritarian, we might actually see some of that become feasible. You know, I mean, at the moment, we don't have a common enemy. You know, governments generally are okay with Bitcoin. They're even generally okay with Monero. You know, I mean, yeah, they might not like some of the stuff that's going on, but they don't like some of the stuff that's going on the internet. They haven't banned the internet. They don't like some of the stuff that's going on Tor. They haven't banned Tor. So I think they're generally okay with the stuff. And because of that, we're a little bit complacent. You know, we're like, okay, well, as long as they haven't banned it, I'm fine with that. And there's no common enemy. But if they become more authoritarian, who knows? I mean, maybe we'll see that as like something that we can all agree we should work against, and something that, you know, like we'll all collectively embrace privacy, and we'll think that privacy on Bitcoin is actually not a bad idea after all. And I mean, of course I won't enjoy it if it takes that to force privacy on Bitcoin, but it's certainly one way it could play out.
Would it basically speed it up if, for example, let's say the DHS could track Monero and then the privacy layer on it would be compromised in a sense? Could that push darknet market users, for example, to use Bitcoin and then start demanding features in Bitcoin or new layers that implement such features?
That's an interesting thing. I mean, yeah, it certainly could. I think that the chances of the DHS having much more insight into Monero than the Monero community already has is unlikely. I mean, the Monero community already, there's a very good series of YouTube videos on breaking Monero, which I, you know, anyone who's seriously interested in this, I recommend watching. There's also every Sunday on Reddit, there's a Skepticism Sunday thread where people talk about all the ways that Monero is broken and will fail. Also, you know, worth going and reading some of the past Skepticism Sunday threads. So yeah, absolutely. Like, it's certainly possible that the IRS or the DHS has some magical tool, but I think it's unlikely that they know more than the very pessimistic and pragmatic Monero community knows. So it's, you know, I think that would be an unlikely turn of events. I also do think that Bitcoin is still pretty popular, as I understand it, and based on stats I've read, Bitcoin's pretty popular on darknet markets still, and it's still used for for criminal activity far more than Monero. I mean, it's, you know, the biggest ransomware demand is Bitcoin by orders of magnitude. And if you look at it from that perspective, like, I'm sure that ransomware authors and, you know, darknet market people who want privacy on Bitcoin are pushing for it. But it's not enough of a groundswell. You know, Bitcoin has a much larger user base than the people that are on darknet markets or the people writing ransomware.
So in comparison to Bitcoin, how do you see Monero's social organization developing? Is there any community behind it that is sticking together based on fundamentals or anything like that?
Yeah, so Monero's community is exceptionally ideological. So let me actually grab this. So there's a website called OpenHub, which tracks open source projects. And I can actually give you the stats.
You can just share your screen, actually.
Oh, that's
right
a great
in
idea.
The corner.
Share the screen. Where is it? I see blur my background, speaker stats, share a YouTube video. Bottom left. Oh, yeah. Of course, it would help if I actually listened and, you know, to things like bottom left. Okay. So, yeah, not my best work. Okay, cool.
Oh, yeah, there we go.
So this is OpenHAB's view of Monero and,
that's the wrong one.
Bitcoin. There. I just wanted to open Bitcoin as well. And what's great is sort of just seeing, in a nutshell, Monero's had, 25,809 commits by 636 contributors. And Bitcoin, is sitting on 852 contributors. So it's not like Monero has a insignificant number of people working on it. The other thing I like is the stat over here on the development team size. So over the past 12 months, 162 developers contributed new code to Bitcoin. This is one of the largest open source teams in the world and is in the top 2% of all projects on OpenHAB. Let's go back here. Monero is sitting at 95 developers over the past 12 months. So, you know, not too dissimilar, 95 versus 162. And then overall 636 versus 851. So these, you know, in terms of like a development community, both Bitcoin and Monero have extremely strong communities. And I do think it starts at a development level. You know, I mean, you can't really, unless you're like Ethereum and DeFi, you can't build a community around hype. You build a community around technology. And then other people come in later who want to speculate in that. But like, you have to start with the technology. You need to start with engineers. And both Bitcoin and Monero have excellent engineers and are engineering first projects. So I think from that perspective, there's a lot of similarity, which is great. And Monero's community is like I said, it's ideological. The Monero's community is built around a desire for privacy. Bitcoin's community, I find, in general, there's more of a focus around self-sovereignty and hard monetary systems, and that's, you know, that's not to say that the Monero community doesn't care about self-sovereignty or hard monetary systems, but the focus is very much privacy, and that carries through in a lot of things. So, how do I see Monero's community sort of playing out or ending up being structured? I do think that Monero, in the grand scheme of things, will probably always be a little bit niche. And maybe a good example of this is if you think about Tor browser versus Firefox, you know, or Google Chrome. More people are using Chrome and Firefox than Tor browser. That does not mean that Tor is an insignificant project. It does not mean Tor browser does not have a lot of users. It just means that practically speaking, mainstream, when they think of an internet browser, when they think of, you know, using an internet browser, their first thought does not go to Tor browser. Their first thought goes to like, oh yes, I click the web icon on my phone. And I think that that's really the difference, right? Bitcoin is very much a mainstream technology, just in terms of mindshare, in terms of user base. And that's absolutely, I think, where it's going to go in future. I think as the technology improves, as the user experience improves, it's going to continue to capture mindshare. It's going to continue to capture new users who, you know, are less like they're not really technical. They're just there for like whatever, like the money or their experience or the whatever. Whereas Monero is more niche, and it'll continue to be niche. I don't think Monero is ever going to become the world's greatest or the world's largest cryptocurrency by any measure, and that's fine. That's absolutely fine, and I think the Monero community is totally fine being a privacy focused smaller community.
Is there any other privacy shitcoins that you're interested in?
yeah, d- Dash is great. I'm kidding. I can't say that with a straight face. I tried really hard, but I can't say that with a straight face.
I have a line of other questions also still. So, but do tell this one. It's really interesting. What's with a straight face about it?
Yeah, I know. Dash is just outright garbage. Look, if I'm being really honest, I do think that the Zcash engineers try really hard to improve privacy, but they have this, there's so many problems. I mean, it's just a centralized organization that's just, there's no path for them to ever become decentralized. So it is what it is, and you can see it. You can see it in their marketing. You can see it in everything that they do. There's no grassroots organization around it. It's just, it's a bunch of VCs and a company, and then like a handful of people who think that they're going to get rich if they buy Zcash before the halving. And that's cool. Like that works for them, and it lets them continue to build interesting technology. By all means, more power to them. I don't think that anyone's ever really going to use it and rely on it for their privacy, but it shouldn't stop them from building. In terms of other cryptocurrencies that are doing interesting things in the privacy space, I think that Grin is certainly doing interesting things. Sadly, very underutilized. It just never really got the sort of community support that it needed, and that which makes me kind of sad because it's really interesting. Beyond that, we're building stuff at Tari, but okay, Tari's a sidechain, so it doesn't really count. But it's Mimblewimble based, so there's that. There's nothing else really. Everything else, all of the other like Mimblewimble clones and all of the other stuff out there is largely trash. The Zcoin guys, they're also doing some interesting stuff. Again, not really seeing a lot of usage, not really seeing a lot of shilling on Twitter, which is good or bad. It's good that they're building. It's probably bad from a market perspective that no one's shilling it on Twitter. That's kind of like besides that, there's not much that I see that's interesting. There's just a lot of trash.
What do you think about Zuko Wilcox? What do you think about the fact that he still gets his grocery shopping costs from like minor donations that he had to extend because he's gonna go starving next week?
Gotta pay. He's got expensive groceries. If that was my grocery bill, I'd worry about it.
Have you ever tried like the Lidl or the Aldi, like the budget ale there or something?
Aldi's definitely a lot more affordable than whatever grocery shop he's going to.
Never heard anything else beyond Whole Foods or something.
I mean, what is he doing? Buying like all of Whole Foods when he walks in? I'm very confused about what where that money's going to. Their burn rate is excessive. It's very high.
He gets it minted freely by the miners, so it's quite easy for him.
I mean, to be honest, I'm a little bit jealous. If I had miners throwing money at me like that, I'd be sitting pretty. I'm doing it wrong.
You could always just, hard fork Monero or something, and if you want a miner tax or something.
I couldn't even convince the Monero community to embrace ASICs, much less pay me money. I'm obviously doing it wrong. Jeez. So my favorite Zuko story of all time was Consensus, a few years ago, I walked into one of the boardrooms to get interviewed. It was one of the press rooms to get interviewed by, I don't know, it wasn't Cointelegraph, CoinDesk probably. And Zuko was in there getting interviewed already, and Jimmy Song was there too. And when Zuko saw me, his face just dropped, and he was he was so cold, and he got up and walked out. And I was just like, wow, okay, clearly I've made him pretty angry. I should probably stop trolling Zcash on Twitter. And he said afterwards, I heard that he called me a bad actor. And I take offense at that because I think my acting is pretty good. And I'm very offended that he said I'm a bad actor because, He's never even seen me act. I don't know how he can, you know, what cheek to call me a bad actor. Bad actor. So that's my Zuko story.
My ones are really crap because when I met him in person, I was like, he was just like, you know, shooting the whole fact that he was on the cypherpunk mailing list that Satoshi was on. And that was like his whole opening story when I met him. And it was like, you know, like just to, you know, to ape the noobs or something or the investors.
Well,
but what do you think about this whole thing that there is a mining tax? Do you see like any point to it? Because, like, I mean, I understand that shitcoins have a really hard time getting people to contribute. but, you know, like, getting they kind of force people who do the proof of work in order to contribute through taxation. Is this immoral or something in your opinion?
So here's my thought, right? I don't actually fundamentally have a problem with a dev tax, but I have a fundamental problem with a dev tax on a base layer cryptocurrency. And let me explain what I mean by that. A base layer cryptocurrency is something like Bitcoin or Monero, or even Ethereum, right? It's you've got these proof of work miners, and that's how the emission of the currency happens. The thing is, it needs to be like that base layer currency needs to be sacrosanct. It needs to be treated with care because the emission, if you start messing around with the emission, then you're basically destroying the monetary system. So if you take a look at like Ethereum, who like have, you know, revised the monetary system 17 times and no one can even tell you how many Ethereum will eventually exist, like that destroys fundamentally the social contract. Whereas with Bitcoin and with Monero, there is a fixed emission curve that was set at the beginning and it has not and will not change. So I feel like that's so important because it is, you know, it's critical to the soundness of the monetary system. Now, if you had to do like a sidechain, so let's say Counterparty, for example. Counterparty did proof of burn, but let's imagine that Counterparty did something different, or Namecoin even. You know, I mean, Namecoin's merge mined with Bitcoin. I would not have a problem if the Namecoin developers said, you know what, guys, we're going to take 10% or 20% of block rewards and it's going to come to the Namecoin Foundation. We're going to use that to develop Namecoin. Because there's no reliance on Namecoin emission being sacrosanct or being sound. It's, you know, their security model relies on Bitcoin. And so they don't need to worry about the soundness of that security model, the soundness of the emission curve. The problem with Zcash is like they're claiming to be a money, they're claiming to be a hard money, and yet like the claims about the emission curve haven't been thrown out. I mean, it was like, here's the emission curve, here's the bit that the Zcash people, developers, investors, founders, scientists, whatever are going to get. And then after 4 years, when that ran dry, they were like, oh, we put it to the community and they decided to give us another 4 years. I mean, like, no, okay.
First, he actually lied about that before, yeah, because exactly. I was there at ZCon 1 and he said that they're going to double down and put all the money in and then they just not going to go for the extension. And not even a month passed and he started backpedaling on it, basically.
Yeah. I mean, it's total garbage. It really is.
Basically,
it is. It is. And half the conversations in the community are between Zcash people. So, you know, like, it's like you how to buy a community and have them vote for you. And I feel it's disingenuous. And I also feel like a dev tax should never exist. A dev tax and a pre-mine should never exist on a base layer currency. Simple as that. If you want to stuff around with dev taxes and pre-mines, no problem. Just at least be merge mined so that your security model doesn't rely on that. Then you can do whatever you want. You know, I can create a merge mined currency tomorrow and give 100% to myself. Like, that's no problem at all. Because the fundamentals are not, the fundamental security model is not relying on what miners earn. And it's just like, it actually boggles my mind that the Zcash didn't think to make it merge mined with Bitcoin. Like that alone would have made it, like I would have less to complain about.
Interesting. Also, I have a last question here from this guy who never didn't manage to talk to us. He's asking you because he'd be wanting to ask you a question, and I'm going to read this.
Sure.
I wanted to ask him on what he thinks about Litecoin and his future, because it's more use crypto on payments at the Hackers Congress.
Interesting. I didn't know that. So, you know, I mean, look, I'm friends with Charlie Lee. So let me preface that. You know, I like Charlie. I've held very little Litecoin over the past past sort of 8 years, 8.5 years that I've been in crypto. I did it very early on. I mined Litecoin, but I also mined the things that preceded Litecoin. So yeah, it's like. I don't find Lightning. Lightning. I've not found Litecoin fundamentally interesting until recently, because I do think the Mimblewimble stuff is interesting, and I'm very curious to see what that looks like. I don't think it's going to provide a model for anything on Bitcoin. I don't think Bitcoin's going to take the Lightning. I don't think Bitcoin's going to take the Litecoin Mimblewimble stuff and try and apply it to Bitcoin. I don't see that as a path, but it is interesting to me just technologically. I don't think that means I'm actually going to go and like buy Litecoin or use Litecoin, but certainly it's, you know, I'm interested to see the development there. And that's like, apart from being buddies with Charlie and being interested in the Mimblewimble development, I don't really have much more to say on the topic.
Last question. So what do you think? Is Bitcoin Core the problem for that's blocking Bitcoin's development?
Frankly, I think Bitcoin Core's gatekeeping is the thing that's protecting Bitcoin development. And I know that might be controversial, but Bitcoin is an incredibly large financial system. Not only is it a very large financial system, but if anything happens to Bitcoin, everything else collapses. If Bitcoin is you know, that example we were talking about earlier, if there's you know, some sort of inflation attack or whatever, if that actually happens and it destroys Bitcoin, everything gets taken down with it. No one walks out of that like surviving. So I look at it from that perspective, and I do not envy the pressure that the Bitcoin Core developers must feel to get things right. And yes, it means that things take time, but frankly, having contributed to open source projects for a long time, open source projects generally are kind of, you know, messy, and they take time. There's no real way to make them go faster. And I think it's okay to just accept that and to just go like, you know, open source projects are chunky and difficult and slow, and Bitcoin doubly so because of the complexity. So, you know, for now, I consider the Bitcoin Core developers the solution, not the problem. And I don't see that changing in future.
That's cool. All right. Well, thank you very much for coming. I really appreciate talking with you. And this was a lot better than I actually thought it was going to be going.
Thank you so much for the chat. It was a lot of fun.
Overblown my expectations. So thanks a lot for coming. And let's give it over for John Galt, who's going to be doing the next session. So see you, Fluffy.
Cheers, everyone.
Bye-bye.